So I'm from Interact for Health, a regional foundation that funds in the Cincinnati area. And we've been doing a local BRFSS-like data collection product for over a decade, which I'm going to talk about that today as soon as I figure out how to change. I have no relationships to disclose. So Interact for Health, as I said, it's a regional health foundation that invests in the health of our communities, crosses 20 counties and 3 states, and we believe that everybody deserves to live in a healthy community. We, as a panel, decided we each wanted to talk about the data gap that our work is attempting to fill. And our data gap, when the foundation, we are also a health conversion foundation, about 20 years old, and when the foundation was founded, we realized that there was health data everywhere, but nobody was willing to share it. So our data gap was really get the data out of people's filing cabinets and make it available to everybody. And that's been our goal for the last 20 years. High quality, publicly available data consistently across our 20 counties and 3 states. So why Interact for Health? Why philanthropy? Again, it's been a goal. We've been doing the survey I'm going to talk about since 1996. Its goal is to track changes in regional social determinants of health, health behaviors, and health status. And with this long history now, we are really able to track changes at a reasonably local level and see where our health is getting better or worse across a number of very important factors. We bring the data and analysis to our community partners for free. It's community money that was used to collect it, and we believe that we owe that to the community who provided the dollars. We also, like Rochelle, put our data into an online data system, so all of the raw data files are available for researchers also for free. A quick note about the pictures. This was something we added to our most recent data collection process, and these are pictures taken by a local newspaper photographer who did a terrific job. In the reports, there are pictures of really local people. There are no stock photos, and we have found that to be a tremendously powerful tool. As people look through their neighborhood or county-level reports, they see people they know and buildings they know. And this little boy is one of my favorites, although I would point out that our survey is adult-focused, so we don't actually, the data I'm talking about today doesn't include kids. And in addition to the survey I'm going to talk about today, we work in Kentucky with the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky on the Kentucky Health Issues Poll, and in Ohio also on a statewide public opinion poll. So, our partners. On this project, we partner very closely with hospitals, with other funders, with health researchers, with the public health departments on the questions that we ask. So we start very early with our partnerships. What worked last time? What didn't work? What should we be asking? What can we toss out? We also have newly developed partnerships with economic development groups. They all use the data. We paid for the survey along with our local United Way. And the local United Way has set up bold goals for our community. And you'll see the yellow that is faded out, those are the goals around education. The red strip in the middle are our community's goals around income. And then the purple on the far right are our community's big, bold goals around health. And those health goals are being measured by the survey that we do at the foundation. And the goals are the 70% goal is that 70% of the community will report having excellent or very good health. So this is what we call self-reported health. It's very well established in the literature as being very predictive of actual health. So the way people vision their health is very connected to morbidity and mortality. The second goal is around access to care. So 95% of the community will report having a usual and appropriate place to go for medical care. And these goals are all with a deadline of 2020, so burning goals. I think that is sufficient for here. So we have about 300 to 400 local organizations that have signed on to these goals, from the business community, nonprofit providers, all the health departments. So we are all trying to look at our work and revision it in achieving these goals. This is the data archive that Rochelle talked about, where we put all the data for the community researchers to use. So what about our survey? It, like many before me, it's a random digit dial telephone survey. It takes about 25 minutes to complete. I don't know how you get people on the phone for 45. It includes cell phones, neighborhoods. It's all self-reported data, like most health surveys. It's also conducted by the University of Cincinnati's Institute for Policy Research. Our next survey will be next year, and we're moving toward an annual model. So historically, we've done this every couple of years. That's no longer satisfactory to our users. We're going to move towards doing something annually so the data seem more recent. These are some of the topics that were on the recent community health status survey, very Burfus-like, similar to what you would expect there. It's 120 questions. Things that the community has determined are important. This is, who's familiar with the Cincinnati area? Raise your hand if you're at all familiar with the area. My colleagues? Okay, great. So you'll see, I just wanted to give you a sense of our region. The dark lines in the middle separate Indiana on the left, Ohio on the right, and Kentucky, my shared region with Rochelle on the bottom part of the map. The little bit darker areas are areas where we did oversamples that were paid for by folks in the community. So in general, the survey covers multiple counties, but in some cases we were able to go deeper. And in the city of Cincinnati there in the middle, that's our urban core, we did neighborhood level work, which is some of the most exciting work we've been doing lately. Here is a map of the city of Cincinnati and four of the five neighborhoods that we oversampled, which I will talk about in a little bit. So what are we seeing after collecting all of these data regionally over time? Self-reported health. So remember back to our community's bold goal. You'll see that the dotted line is our bold goal, 70% of adults reporting excellent or very good health. That sort of gray tan line next is national data. And then we are in orange, so pretty flat, consistent over time at 50%. We have a lot of work to do. If I showed you this graphic by income, you would see that folks over 200% are really close to the goal, and folks under 100% are really far from it. So we have a lot of demographic data we can dive into to figure out where pockets of folks are that we need to work on. To stay with the smoking theme, we also have a pretty high smoking rate in our region, 25%. You'll see Cincinnati data is in orange, headed downward, but still well above the nation in gray and far above our Healthy People 2020 goal of 12%. Obesity over time. See, when you have these long trend lines, you can really start to see where changes are happening. Again, we are more obese than the rest of the country and higher than the Healthy People 2020 goal as a region. Chronic conditions. We recently shifted our focus from healthcare access to health promotion, but having these data available continues to be critical to our work. What we see over time here is that high blood pressure is the line at the top of the graphic, has been going up and remains the leading chronic condition in our area, followed by high cholesterol. Depression is the purple line, the third one from the top, and we saw a big jump between 2000 and 2005 that has consistently remained there, and then the remaining of the chronic conditions at the lower on the graphic. So what did we see when we started looking at neighborhoods? I want to tell you about a neighborhood in Cincinnati. It's called Avondale. It's population 8,000. Predominantly African American, historically African American neighborhood, 89% African Americans. It's in the center of town, the hospital, the zoo, there's a whole bunch of big cultural organizations there, and 40% report no access to transportation. Poverty is also higher in this neighborhood than others. We've been doing local area data collection there now twice. We will be doing a third round. And when we ask them self-reported health, so again, this is tied back to our community-wide goal, you can see Avondale, our neighborhood, is in green. So we have our bold goal of 70%, our greater Cincinnati rate of about 50, and our Avondale goal. And you see there's a difference, right? So in collecting data at the super hyper-local level, we're starting to be able to measure change at a geography that is meaningful to people. And this neighborhood has seen dramatic change between 2010 and 2013. So they suddenly became very, very interested in our data. They were interested, but they became very, very interested. Community support. So on this survey, we ask a number of questions about how supported you feel in your community, which we know is a proxy for social connectedness and change, and is critical to health improvement. And the question was, does living in your community give you a secure feeling? And so we see in Greater Cincinnati, the rate stayed about the same in the 80s, but in Avondale we saw a big shift, the green, from 68% to 64%. So we're seeing some leading indicators in a community that's critical to us going in the right direction. This is also Avondale data, and it's obesity, so BMIs over 35. I can't explain this, though. That's one of the beauties of data collection. Sometimes you don't know what exactly is going on. So the BMI is going in the right direction, right? 45 to 28, the green line is going down, which is what we would want to see. Folks on the ground don't report the same observation, so I can't explain this, but I thought I would share it. We can celebrate it, right? So one of the changes, again, was the link between economic development and health improvements. This is a shot of one of our other neighborhoods. We added community environments to our survey at the request of the community, so housing and healthy neighborhood questions. We also did a bunch of oversamples by race and ethnicity, which are all available on our website. The only known random digit dial Latino health focus survey that we know about. Somebody else is making a presentation on that later today. We have a large population of Appalachians in our region, both migrants and Appalachian counties, so we have data on their health as well. African American health, we've been collecting data on African American health since the beginning of the survey. So I'm going to just, as a final note, share some of those data with you. This is our bold goal, our self-reported health goal for African Americans. You can see our bold goal of 70% is the dotted line. Next comes white, around 52%. And then our African American line, which had an unusual blip in 2002, but settled back into 40%. So we have work to do. I wanted to share some good news. So inappropriate source of care. So these are adults who report going to an emergency room or urgent care center when they are sick or need advice about their health. So the gray line shows our white population, the green line shows the African American population. You can see it went way up in 2005 and came back down. Our community worked very aggressively on this, so we'd like to think that that's what drove the change. But, you know, with population health data, you never exactly know. My last slide is those neighborhood questions I talked about. So how would you rate your neighborhood as a healthy place to live? You see the two top lines, 1 year of data only because we added them on the last survey year. At 26% of African Americans rate their neighborhood as healthy, as excellent or very good when it comes to healthy, compared to 50% of whites. In the good category, it's closer, 37% to 30%. In the fair poor, many more African Americans at 37%. Report their neighborhood as not healthy compared to whites. This is how you can get a hold of me at Interact for Health and our webpage where all of the comprehensive reports on these data are available. Thank you.
Thank all of you, and I wanted to thank our presenters for being so efficient on time. We do have a bit of discussion availability here. I first wanted to just sort of get a sense of who is in the room. How many of you work with funders? Our funders? Just about everybody who is. If anybody local or state public health, people that are data users, who researchers that need this information. Okay. I wanted to kick things off with sort of a self-serving question. They let me be moderator, so I get to go. You guys have shown amazing projects that each of your foundations are working with. How can other funders get in this game? Where was the leadership that said, yes, we're going to be data-driven? How do you pitch this to your boss? How do you get started if you're not currently investing in data and health indicators?
Well,
I'll
start. So I wasn't there at the beginning, but my understanding is that it was a awesome idea, which I think is always a good place to start. And it really came from, in 1996, they funded data collection in our area, and then the person that collected the data refused to give it to us. So they would only give us sort of the annual report form and not the raw data, and that was just icing on the cake for the realization that, you know, if you can't get your hands on the raw data, you can't do the analysis that your organization is interested in doing. So, and the fact that we cover three states makes everything more complicated. So I think it's really about data as a means to improving community health and long-term commitment to it and, you know, get it to be the boss's idea.
If I could just build on that, I think you really captured a lot. I'm realizing, when did CHIST seem really important to us? It was Native California. And I think it had to do with what we were really grappling with, the uninsured, the rate of the uninsured. And we used CHIST data. We commissioned them to do special research for a program, a subsidized healthcare product that we created called California, the Children's Health Plan, which is, and in order to, and so every year we would wait with bated breath, what is the uninsurance rate? What is it by county? What are you, you're right, data. But it was so deeply important to my organization, and we had a lot of people who were public health folks and who really knew and trusted the value and the high quality of the data that was coming out of the CHIPS. We had a picture, we had to sell it, I still have to sell it every year. We get $2 million, I think, one from Northern California, $1 million from Southern California. It's not an inconsequential amount of money. People are saying, why doesn't the state just do this? Which is a very good question, but it's not going to happen.
So. You walk into your doctor, and he says to you, I have bad news. One of your organs is failing, and we need you surgery. And you quickly say, well, which organ? And she says, I can't tell you. I don't have that data. Who's going under the mat? Just show your hands. Who's going under the mat? So why do our communities deserve any less than you? And that's the clear argument for us. You know, we have Griffith's data that tell us at a state level, in some places at a county level, what our data are, but that's not enough to be precise. You know, precision public health and the movement towards precision public health has to be grounded in data. And if you are comfortable enough that you will have more data available to you when you go to buy your couch than you can when you are, you know, trying to plan for your community, then don't get into this game. It is partly our challenge and our fault as researchers that we have mystified data and made it a research process and stuff that stays in journals and stays in high academic powers. This is about driving practice. And as Yogi Berra said, unless you know where you're going, you won't know when you're lost. And the data lets us know where we're going. And if that's not an easy reach for a board, and again, for a lot of us, ask your board members, are you willing to do our finances and our investing on data that are 2 years old and aren't specific? And they'll say no. And then you ask them, then why do you want to do the program now? Very simple.
For a lot of other things, but historically over the long run, they're arch rivals. So typically things are, speaking of university researchers, how at the University of Kentucky or at the University of Louisville, there's extreme competition for state dollars going to different universities, there's extreme competition. So the foundation can step in and say, as we like to say, the neutral convener to be in the space to support that. We do have an outside evaluator who's evaluating the work of the foundation, and when they ask Kentucky legislators and other stakeholders, they cite Kentucky Health Issues Poll and the foundation being in the space as being a neutral convener. So I think that's why it makes the foundation the perfect space to have this data and hold this data. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say too that the foundation and Interact have been asking for a number of years Kentucky's opinion about the Affordable Care Act. Kentucky is an expansion state. We've expanded Medicaid. We have a new governor coming in to be elected tomorrow. So we have great data from Kaiser Family Foundation on nationwide opinions on the Affordable Care Act, but we were able to look at that closer in Kentucky and see where Kentuckians thought about the Affordable Care Act. So that's why the foundation is perfect for that.
Well, I'd like to differentiate. I think you were asking about why foundations would create and hold the data, but I think there are other roles. In our case, we don't create or hold this particular set of data. We support it. We are engaged with the shaping of it. We are users of it, but we're funders. So, and I feel like that's also important to be able to have publicly available data that is, you know, that is supported by multiple funders, including, in our case, the government.
So we do both and in the university a very well established RCDA collect data in both of our cases, and then we have internal operating mechanisms to analyze the data, so we can be very flexible with the angle we choose to take with the questions that we've asked and how quickly we can turn around the analysis when something blows up in the community or somebody looking for data relative to an issue they are passionate about. So, you know, I think a number of folks on the panel have talked about turnaround time, and we brought the analysis in-house because of that, so we could turn it around more quickly in to serve the community.
So it actually goes to another project that we're doing with Colorado Health Foundation, Kresge Foundation, and Robert Johnson Foundation. The driving work company, our Build Health Challenge. Build is bold, upstream, integrated, local, and data-driven. And it was really important. It's about, I think, creating the conversation, right? And it's just, you know, it's nothing changes unless you start talking about it. And it is very easy. If you're spending 10 years in practice, you know, the quickest way you end a conversation is some lawyer yells out FERPA if you're talking about education, or somebody yells out PIPA if you're talking about health. And that kind of ends the conversation. It doesn't need to, right? There are very clear provisions within HIPAA to share with public health departments. There are ways to do it, but someone has to push, right? And really start talking about the fact that we just simply don't have the information that we need to make the choices that we must and allocate our resources appropriately at the community level. And so, again, give me any example. I mean, I said this a couple of years ago in a interview that I thought was off the record at the moment, which is flipping comment, but, you know, show me another profession where two-year-old data makes headlines and I'll buy you lunch. I mean, coming out of the National Children's Survey, Georgia was the second highest rate of obesity among 10 to 17-year-olds in 2007. Well, 4 years later, when those data came out again, we were 37. And we celebrated that for no reason. We didn't do anything. The governor took great credit for it. He wasn't elected at the time those data were collected. Right? So unless we start the conversation and start poking the holes in the data that we use, you know, every time a state health commissioner or local health commissioner comes in and says, show me this teen pregnancy data. Well, I can show you the teen pregnancy data from 2 years ago. I have no idea what it is today. And until we start having those conversations and getting really passionate about the fact that there's almost no decision that we make in our lives without information. And if that's how we're going to treat community health, then just screw it and let's all go and put our money somewhere else and let the community fend for itself.
So in our case, all of the grants we give, they're required to use their data.
I'm Carrie Bachman from Southern New Mexico. I work actually for a nonprofit, so I'm sort of an outlier here. But I'm wondering, we've done some participatory mapping with community members in the border area of Mexico, U.S. And do you all see a role of that in the data collection, and how might
actually I think it's a really interesting challenge, and thank you for suggesting the landscape, because you want to capture information that's local and actually makes sense, and where people see a reflection of their perception of reality. So we do things like photo voice, etc. But then there's a lot of critique that people have about how the pictures are taken and how they're collected, and then how are they used, how can they be used more broadly? You know, do you upload them? I mean, did that become your reality? We actually don't share data from grants that we fund, and we have some concerns about that. I think there are, you know, ownership questions, who owns the data. So I think you're putting on a really important issue, which I wonder will be part of sort of the evolution of the work, including that the technical capacity is there. People are, you know, they're using apps to show where they have asthma attacks, right? And that's, so I'm wondering if some of the more, much more time-sensitive, but not validated experiences are validated. It is valid, but they're not scientifically validated.
So I think it would be a really good for academics, you know, for that practitioner-academic combination. It's not in what the data are or how they're collected, it's the information gap that you're filling. And as long as you're starting there, you know, what don't we know that we need to know to have impact and assess our impact? Starting there, qualitative, quantitative, you know, narrative, story, any number of thousand things fit into the term data. Data is an extraordinarily broad term that we often, unfortunately, you know, boil down to surface. But it's so much more. I think if you're doing, if you're meeting a need through your community, then that's great research and that's great data. And the fact that we can put some of this into the peer-reviewed literature is great. But ultimately, what we're trying to do is drive action and change, and so that should dictate. I remember when I was in Philadelphia, my women's health director came in, and she said, "Hey, I'm going to do a survey." I said, "Really? I'm going to do a pelvic." And she was just shocked. She was given the position, "You can't do a pelvic. Well, you're not a survey researcher. You can't do a survey." Because she was starting with her method. She wasn't starting with her question. She wasn't starting with her problem. She just had in her head she's going to do a survey. And that's where we have to go back to the purpose of research and data collection is to answer a question we have and to solve a problem that we need addressed. If we start there, whatever method we get to is the right one.
But are there any sort of pratfalls and potholes that you experience in the development that these guys can avoid based on your trial and error?
A couple, yes. I think the question of sustainability is really big. So that's one reason we're funding CHIS. As you can hear, it's great, but it bothers me that some questions aren't there year after year, so you don't get the chance to see trend data because the funder, you know, disappeared. So I think before you, as you're building something new, don't get deterred to not create something new. But I do think thinking about sustainability is very important. I think it's really hard to get people to use websites, so I didn't even mention the national CHNA.org. So we have this great resource, it's free. Who knows about it? And how do you keep it refreshed? And it's not going to be comprehensive. So how do people link to other resources that may be really good but complementary? And I don't think we're actually doing a great job of helping people figure that out.
For the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky, I think there's two pieces where the main challenges lie. One is the questions that come from the community, we have to put the lens on, is this mission related? So as I mentioned, we're promoting responsive health policy, so although Southwest New Mexico sounds like you're doing fantastic work, I visit related to our mission. Those are the questions we want to drive forward in the Kentucky Health Issues Pool. So that's one piece. So we have to say no if it's not mission related. So for example, a group approached us wanting to ask about radon exposure and how much people knew about radon. It's an important issue in Kentucky. We have a lot of limestone and there's some radon exposure, but it wasn't mission aligned enough where we could offer that question based upon the Kentucky Health Issues Poll. The other thing is something Brian alluded to, people don't do surveys and they think it's an easy thing to do. So the Oral Health Coalition wanted to ask, you know, a 15-item question about knowledge of fluoride. that's not going to work out for us. I'm going to catch up with you fall. We're only keeping people on the phone for 20 minutes. So, or another question, maternal and child health group was interested in learning about the percentage of Kentuckians that took folate during their pregnancy. Right? There's too many questions those methodologists, folks in the audience. There's too many problems asking that on a telephone public opinion survey. So that's where I get into the challenges of on the Kentucky Outpatient Poll. But they're extremely fun challenges, and I'm honored to be working there. So when we pitch this question, we ask people, what do you want to know about? How do you think you'll use the data? Have you seen any questions that you might want to use? So again, it's a tiny little piece of the capacity building too that we're offering out to the community. So how do you want to use the data? You know, you want to know how if people took folate. Okay, great, but then what? So those are some of the challenges we face.
So one of the challenges that I haven't figured out how to overcome is when you collect high quality data and make it publicly available, you don't control the message anymore. Mm-hmm. So Rochelle and I have recently been quoted in High Times because we asked questions around marijuana approval, and the data were flipped and used in the way that neither one of the foundations would have hoped. Several years ago, in Ohio, we passed the smoke free legislation. Some of our data, I was often quoted with the alcohol and smoking lobby because some of our data didn't show a majority support for smoke free laws and bars. So some of this, if you're transparent, you can't control the message anymore if you're really sharing the data widely. So that's one of the risks that our organization has accepted.
So I would just be clear about your WIFM, you know, what's in it for me, whether it's your board, whether it's the business community, whether it's the advocates in your community, and you have to be very clear about why are you collecting these data? Because we do have a pretty significant stigma to overcome that for many years we collected data for the sake of data to write papers and get tenure. Right? So I mean, my board was the first to say, why are we doing this? Is this the research? We're not a research foundation. Right. But I don't know where to shoot yet. I don't know how to really do a workforce policy with no good workforce data. So I can shoot blind, or I can shoot in a very thoughtful, precise way if I just add these data. Will we publish off of them? Absolutely. Will we put in the peer review version? Absolutely. But it'll be, what's in it for us, and what it was in it for the board, was better, more impactful, more measurable projects, because we had baseline data, then we would act, and then we would evaluate. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you get to a real assessment of our impact as philanthropy without some set of data that guide us in how we've done. And without that, then we're just continuing to, you know, get back to philanthropy 1.0. There's a check good luck. There's a check good luck. I mean, we are accountable to our boards. We're accountable to our donors. In some kind of universal sense, this donor is still looking on from the universe saying, what do you do with the money? So we need this information to show that we have done good work and that we are really making change. And so, again, I hope that everyone in the room takes back, you know, what are the information challenges that you have in your foundation? What are the information challenges that you have in your grant making, that you have in your community? And how are you going to solve that problem? And as I reflect a lot on why we do these things, because, you know, we all come to Chicago and we leave our family. My wife's birthday, she's home with our two kids alone, God bless her. The overly active 6 and 4 year old. But we come here so that there's been some change, that we can share knowledge and inspire other people to do something different. And so hopefully next year when we do this, it's 4 different foundations telling us about their new data set and then how that new data set really got them to move and advance their practice and their brand name. I think that's our chance.
I don't see
it on
hand, but I think that was a fantastic note to end on. So thank you very much for your time.